Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Welcome to another installment in the Law and Social Innovation podcast series, an initiative of the Eugene and Carol Ludwig Center for Community and Economic Development at Yale Law School. This podcast series explores the intersection of creative community development through inspired and inspiring social change. Research indicates that some 30 to 40 million households across America lack adequate access to traditional financial services. One institution is working with both banks and consumer services advocates in an effort to transform the U.S. financial services marketplace and help unbanked and underbanked consumers achieve financial prosperity. Lindsay Counts, a second-year Yale Law student, sat down with Rachel Snyder of the Center for Financial Services Innovation to discuss the organization's vision for banking the unbanked, its impact to date, and why this work is so important.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're hoping that we might start out by getting you to tell us a little bit about the CFSI, its vision, and its mission.
Sure, I'm happy to. So CFSI is the Center for Financial Services Innovation, and we were founded in 2004. And our mission is to advance the marketplace that serves underbanked consumers. And we envision a world in which low and moderate income consumers have access to the financial services that they need to help them achieve greater financial prosperity.
So when we speak of the unbanked or the underbanked, what do we mean by this term? Are there some sort of metrics that we use to characterize people as such?
There are. People use slightly different versions of this definition, but basically what it means is that people who are unbanked don't have either a checking account or a savings account at all. And people who are underbanked have either a checking or a savings account at a traditional financial institution, but also rely on a wide array of alternative financial services, including payday lending, check cashing, money orders, a whole set of services. And what's interesting in some ways is that this isn't a static population. People seem to go in and out of being banked or unbanked or underbanked over time.
And do we have a sense of why that is, that so many households are unbanked or underbanked?
There's probably a variety of reasons that this is a huge part of the American population, 30 to 40 million households. So it's hard to make any generalizations that would apply to a group that's that big. But some of this group is composed of immigrants who are new to the country and either don't expect to engage in financial institutions the way that they run in the U.S. or are undocumented. Some portion is people who are lower income and don't think that they have enough money to justify a bank account. So when we've done surveys or the FDIC has done surveys, the kinds of answers you hear, usually that's the first one. I don't have enough money to make an account worthwhile.
And I'm curious about whether or not we have any metrics to speak to sort of who these people are in terms of socioeconomic breakdown or racial breakdown. If you could just say a little more about that, that would be great.
Sure, happy to. So it does tend to be a lower income group, although not entirely. I mean, interestingly, this group does span a pretty wide income bracket, even though the majority is probably among households who are under $35,000 in annual income, approximately. It's a group that has a larger percentage of African-Americans and Hispanics than you find in the general population. So minorities and low-income folks are more likely than non-minorities, non-low-income folks to be or underbanked. And the households tend to be large, which is another, I think, interesting point about underbanked households. So, and that's consistent with lower-income minority households as well, but we generally, when we're talking about households of underbanked folks, you might be talking about a whole extended family network.
So you mentioned briefly that a lot of these households do utilize what you call alternative financial services.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important they have access to traditional financial services also if they are getting their banking needs met somehow or the other?
Well, that's a big debate in the field, actually. So some people think it really doesn't matter as long as people get access to the financial services that they need to make their lives function at a reasonable cost and in a way that can help them build prosperity. But there are some sometimes an inherent advantage to being at a bank versus a non-traditional institution, mostly if you have access to a savings account or access to ways to build credit. So if you're using only check cashing services and money order services, for example, then those services don't enable you to build a longer-term relationship with a financial institution. They probably don't lead you to anywhere to get good financial advice or to begin saving or potentially own a home mortgage. But our financial institutions really changed over the last generation. And so fewer and fewer people rely on a bank in that way and expect to get all of their financial services from one anchoring institution. And so in that context, the alternative providers often provide real advantages. They can be cheaper, they are often more convenient, they have long hours, they sometimes operate out of retailers where people are doing a lot of business anyway. So it's, I think it's hard to definitively say that having a bank account is better than not having a bank account in all ways. But what's clear is that people need better and higher quality access to financial services that make their lives work and enable them to save and invest for the future.
So I understand why why it would be beneficial for certain households to perhaps have this access. I'm curious as to why financial institutions themselves might want to provide better services. What's in it for them?
Well, for underbanked consumers, it's really about a greater share of wallet from their existing customers. Right? Underbanked folks are people who have bank accounts already but don't use them for the full range of the financial services needs. And so there's a real market opportunity, a real profit opportunity for banks and credit unions who are serving those customers to increase in the kinds of services they provide and therefore generate a bigger proportion of the revenue that those services then generate. For unbanked consumers, it's really about expanding your market altogether. So we are seeing some banks and credit unions recognize that there's a big opportunity here to expand the market that they serve and build their business.
Is it possible that these individuals can be banked in sort of a safe and responsible manner while it is still being made profitable for the institutions themselves? Have you gotten any feedback on that? If you could say more, that would be great.
Absolutely. So certainly it is absolutely possible to generate a profit while serving lower-income customers responsibly. What it requires is to calibrate the services that you offer to the needs of those customers appropriately. So what I mean by that is that the traditional checking account probably isn't it. That's not the way to get an underbanked consumers into the branch and serve them profitably. There's pretty substantial embedded costs in the branch network that retail banks have, for example. There is a whole set of technology costs embedded in the infrastructure. So using the existing product and infrastructure and distribution network is not necessarily what's going to lead a financial institution to a profitable, responsible product offering. On the other hand, then, we have a series of examples of banks or credit unions trying something new and different and therefore profitably and responsibly serving this customer base. So one example to point to is there's a credit union in California called Self-Help that has tried essentially a check cashing branch. And so what they've done is they've opened a lower cost, smaller branch that offers traditional check cashing services at a lower price point. And they use that as a way to drive more customers into the credit union. So they're offering their products and services that can be profitably offered for this customer base, but within the context of expecting to build a longer-term, more robust customer relationship. But it's a new and different way to think about banking services. It's not as simple as just opening the same branch you would have opened on Fifth Avenue in a lower-income neighborhood. You've got to shift some things about your business strategy in order to make it work.
So in your opinion, why is it that financial institutions haven't done this before? Are there major obstacles in the way of them providing service to unbanked and underbanked consumers?
There are a whole handful of obstacles. So one obstacle is embedded in what I just described, like trying to develop new strategies is always challenging, and financial institutions have plenty of competing priorities that can get in the way of making this the number one next thing to do next year. So particularly in the last several years, a lot of banks have been understandably focused primarily on how to weather the current financial environment. They have been particularly risk averse at all reasonable expectations. They've been focused on responding to an evolving regulatory environment. So in that circumstance, there are just competing priorities, competing demands on executives' time and on a financial institution's ability to innovate and change.
Could you also just say a little bit about the manner in which CFSI sort of assists these financial services institutions in developing new strategies, or what the relationship is like between yourselves and these entities?
Sure, I'm happy to. So we provide a number of different services to help financial institutions innovate in this space. We provide information and research, so we do consumer research as well as industry research, and we make most of those findings available to the public for free. We also host an annual conference at which we showcase the newest and best ideas in serving underbanked consumers. And this year, that conference is June 13th to 15th in San Francisco. And then we also provide consulting services. So financial institutions can engage us on specific projects to help develop a strategy or a product. And finally, we run networks of companies to help them to learn from each other. So one of those, for example, is the Innovators Roundtable, where we bring together some of the largest financial institutions in the country and facilitate conversations among them, as well as provide access to experts who can help them think about new underbanked strategies.
I thought we might move on to talk a little bit about CFSI's new initiative, the Compass Principles. Would you be able to walk us through what those are, what your hopes for them are?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So this is one of our newest initiatives. We just launched it in September of this year. And the idea behind the Compass Principles is to articulate a set of standards for excellence in the delivery of financial services and to simultaneously articulate why it matters. Why do financial services have the potential to make people's lives better? And how can they do so? Right? So CFSI is founded on this belief, this core belief, that if you have access to and use high-quality financial services, that is an important input into whether and how you can improve your prosperity and your stability as a family. And financial institutions haven't done a terrific job at articulating that or at living up to that potential, really. And so the Compass Principles is about helping industry, helping the marketplace overall to see that potential, to speak to it well, and to live up to it. So what we've done is we've articulated four principles: safety, inclusion, one around pathways, we're calling it, and one around sort of the idea of financial capability around building your own success, your own efficacy as a consumer. And we're describing what those principles mean in greater detail in the white paper that you can find on the compassprinciples.com website. And then we've hosted a series of meetings with financial services executives and consumer advocates, regulators, to talk about what the principles could mean and how financial services institutions could live according to them. So the idea is to be clear about what the goal is. And from our perspective, the goal isn't purely to facilitate cheaper, more convenient transactions. It's to facilitate greater stability, greater financial mobility, and ultimately greater prosperity.
So how will these principles come to work or to govern it in practice for these institutions?
Well, so we're just at the beginning stages of this. The way that we embarked upon the project was we felt like there was a need for a few distinct phases. So the first phase was CFSI conceptualizing what we thought the principles are and should be. And the second stage, which is where we are now, is to solicit feedback about them. So we view the current draft of the Compass Principles as just that, as a draft. And the meetings that we've convened to talk about it have been with the goal of getting feedback about whether or not we've got it right. And so, and then the next phase will really be about encouraging adoption, encouraging people to take action based on the principles. So as one element of the project, and one example of how we think we can pursue adoption of the principles. We've been working to develop a prepaid card-specific version of the principles, calling it the Guide to Prepaid Excellence. And the idea is that we're taking the principles and making them more tactical, more specific to the product of prepaid, and giving examples of what we think it means in the real world to live up to the principles of embrace inclusion, for example. And so the guide will be published in the first quarter of 2012. And between, you know, now and the end of 2012, our goal is really to work with some prepaid card, with some companies who are part of the prepaid card supply chain, to find ways that they will incorporate the principles directly into their business operations.
And do you envision that this would need to maybe work alongside with regulation? So what would the enforcement mechanism be?
Yeah, it's a very good question, right? So we envision a voluntary enforcement mechanism. We don't envision seeking regulation to enforce the principles or to require people to live by them in some way. And part of why we've approached it that way is comes from the fact that we want to set as high a bar as possible. And regulation is really designed to set the lowest bar, if you will, right? It's designed to protect us from harm. And it's not, while the government can and often does play a really important role in encouraging the private sector to do its absolute best work, it's hard to require the absolute and best work. And what we're hoping to inspire with a voluntary set of principles is a race to the top, is a competition for being the best for consumers. And the argument that we're making is really that if you do your best by consumers, your absolute best, that's going to drive consumer loyalty. It's going to drive your business. It's going to bring more people in your doors. And so it should be, in fact, good for business to do your absolute best work by your customer base. And I always feel a little bit Pollyannish when I describe it, but I believe it's true. And I think that customers do compare products. They do evaluate what will be the best in their lives. And they do express extreme loyalty and that when a product works for them. The one example in my mind is that a few years ago we did research with prepaid card users. And prepaid cardholders are often folks who used to have bank accounts and had bad experiences with them for one reason or another. Paid too many overdraft fees, for example, or were kicked out of their bank account because they had insufficient funds. So, and not exclusively, right? I don't want to wrongly characterize the whole prepaid cardholder base in that way, but certainly some of the prepaid cardholder base can be described in that way. And when we did interviews with the prepaid cardholders, what we heard was extraordinary loyalty to this product that let them back into the financial mainstream in their point of view, right? Gave them the ability to have a plastic card in their wallet with a Visa or MasterCard logo. And we heard real emotion around that idea, around, I have this card in my wallet that lets me function as though I didn't have a massive credit problem. You know, I have a card in my wallet that lets me pay my bills online or pay them over the phone. And so I don't have to, you know, get on a bus and go and pay them in person, in cash, on the day that they're due. And you heard real emotion coming from that. And it does drive loyalty. It drives the growth of a company's business. And so we're expecting that the Compass Principles are really about articulating what it means to do your absolute best work by your customers.
How do you know when your work is complete? How would you define success in this area?
A terrific question. It's something we discuss a lot, right? So we want to be able to measure consumer impact. In theory, right, we would describe success when all Americans have access to the financial services and use the financial services that can help them to improve their financial well-being. In reality, we're an intermediary. We don't provide direct service. And so for the most part, we measure impact by gauging whether the supply of financial services is improving. So we track whether or not there are new products on the marketplace that we think show promise. We pay a lot of attention to new entrepreneurs entering this part of the market. And over time, hopefully we'll be able to shift to also tracking how consumers use their financial services. So we do consumer research, and we'd like to be able to use consumer research to measure whether or not individuals truly are better off as a result of using a particular product or service. But so far, we're not there. It's a pretty challenging operational task.
Finally, could you just say a word or two about whether or not there are things that communities or community members could do to assist in this fantastic work that you're doing?
No, it's a good question. I do think we work with so many fantastic community organizations across the country who are really working hard at this problem. So community-based financial institutions, other organizations who have an interest in helping their communities really do have a major role to play here. And I think individuals do, right? I think it's a really challenging thing to manage your own finance as well. We all struggle with it. When I describe to friends or new acquaintances what I do, even though my work is focused mostly on low and moderate income families, what people always say is, oh, I need more of that, right? I need more financial help. And I think it's tough, right? I want to say, you know, what your question makes me think, well, one part of the answer is that we each as individuals do have responsibility for managing our own finances proactively and responsibly, for looking at products and comparing them in order to choose the things that will be best in our lives. So I think individuals and communities do have a role to play there. It's just a mutual role. Companies that provide services have to meet them halfway. And so there really is a supply and a demand element of fixing this problem.
Rachel, thank you so, so much for joining us today and telling us a bit more about your work. We really appreciate it.
I'm happy to do it. Thanks for inviting me.